thanks, Janice. I'm a pacer by nature, so I walk backwards and forwards, but I'll try my best to be rooted to the microphone today. So where's my man to turn the lights down? Thanks very much. Thanks, Janet, for the introduction. This being a citizen scientist, in a sense, is about making a difference, being an activist in our society. And the picture shows you one way in which people are activists. There's some people who are claiming to have saved four Victorian properties in the town of Stocksteth in England from the bulldozers. So, our presentation this week on myself and my team, Tully Hoffman, who's giving the lecture on Thursday, is in the audience. The rest are coming one by one. So how do we make a difference? And I say we can make a difference by building this early warning system for biodiversity. So we produced this little booklet a couple of years ago, and there are copies at the back if you'd like to take one as you go out. So this has been a big theme of the ADU over a long period of time. Perhaps not articulated as building an early warning system, but very much what we've done for the 20 years of our existence. Now, my dad worked in the post office. I was the first person in my family ever to get to university. And my dad I was an only child. And my dad, when I was about 9 or 10 or so, said he had to teach this brat about biodiversity, and wasn't called that then, and we were supposed to do a year on birds and a year on butterflies and a year on this and a year on that. He had it all mapped out, but we never got beyond birds. And he spent his entire working life in the post office. He grew up in the Depression years. He never finished school. He left school in Standard 9 to go and work in the post office, and he died in 1997. He was 78, and I had done Latin for matric at Saxe down the road, and my father, who had done Latin in 1918 or something, had hadn't finished school. He could still tell me the meanings of the Latin scientific names of birds, where they were derived from Latin, deep into his 70s. And I keep reminding myself that if my dad had had the opportunities that I've had, he would have left me in the dirt. So when Rene Navarro, who we gave the job of actually designing our 20th anniversary logo, when he came up with this postage stamp design, I really thought that he wouldn't have known that my dad had actually spent his life in the post office. So this is the second last event. The 20th anniversary was actually, the actual date was the 1st of December last year, so we're still pretty close to it. And the very last event is a celebration of citizen science, which we are putting on in the National Botanic Gardens in Pietermaritzburg next month. So we all know where we are, University of Cape Town, but what I don't think is actually widely known is that UCT is now ranked 103 in the world's universities. And there are thousands and thousands of universities, and UCT is the only university in Africa which was in the top 200 of these things. So you can go and Google top universities, Times Higher Education Supplement, and you can find all the details, and you'll be amazed at what famous universities are ranked lower than UCT. So I'm going to give you two introductions to the ADU. This is all part of what it means to be a citizen scientist. So on our signatures, we often have these words, pairs of words, what we do, citizen science, digital biodiversity, statistical ecology. And another way of expressing it, research, teaching, and the projects that hopefully you people would get involved in. So in our conceptual model for what we do, we have three circles: research, teaching, monitoring projects, and Janet alluded to that in her introduction. We do an awful lot of research, which is measured as scientific papers in journals. For example, there's one from last year, the collapse of South Africa's penguins. And penguins are in dire straits at the present time. And we have a large team of students involved with trying to understand what is going wrong. Until we understand what is going wrong, we can't really come up with any solutions to the problem. So that's one of the things we do, is research. A lot of teaching. We've graduated a large cohort of PhD students and MSc students this millennium. There's one of them, Justine Braby. She was asking various questions on Skype this morning. She graduated in June last year. She did her PhD on another threatened bird species, the Damarat tern, in the Namib Desert. Yaket Barshep, who's almost certainly coming back from Nigeria as a postdoc, got her PhD, and Lauren Waller works for Cape Nature, was one of my penguin PhDs. Then the third part is the part that you people hopefully interface with. It's the bird monitoring projects and the other monitoring projects as well. So here are some of the projects that that we've done at the ADU. Bird ringing, and Ditta will come and tell us about bird ringing on Friday, and I'll be stealing some of his thunder this morning. It's the Butterfly Atlas, which Sylvia Metanira will be talking about. And there's been the Reptile Atlas. We do water bird monitoring. There's a project called Quack, and the chairman of the Cape Bird Club gets up and does his announcements like Janet did before the presentation, and with a totally straight face he says the club will be quacking at Radane Dam this weekend. And to the uninitiated, one actually wonders what on earth they think when the chairman says we're going to go and quack at a wetland. But to go and quack means that you go and count the ducks and other water birds, and that's one of the projects that actually monitors trends in those species. For one of the privileges of living in this country, in the Western Cape in particular, is to go to farmland like around Caledon, Overberg, and Malmesbury, Mariesburg in the Swartland, and to see large terrestrial birds in farm country. And we have a project called CAR, which we tortured the dictionary to call Coordinated Avifaunal Road Counts. And then one of my students pointed out to me that you could have called it Counts Along Roads. And and that project is monitoring birds in farmlands. So that's not a project we're going to be talking about this week, nor is Quack, but we will be talking about SABAP 2, the Southern African Bird Atlas project, the second Southern African Bird Atlas project. We have a project called, we enjoy making acronyms, BIRP, which is the Birds in Reserves project. We have a project called My Bird Patch, and there are things called virtual museums that people can get involved in. So these three parts to the ADU, and they overlap. In actual fact, they overlap a huge amount. So if you do set theory and you know all about Venn diagrams, you'll know that the intersection of those three circles is actually quite a large area. So we are doing research, teaching postgraduate students based on the data collected by the citizen scientists. I retired at the end of last year. I'm delighted that the University of Cape Town has reappointed me as a senior scholar. So life just carries on as it always did. I've been excruciatingly fortunate. And we combine these three things. And so there was a huge uncertainty at the end of last year as I retired. What would happen to the ADU? But clearly there's a commitment on the university's part to keep it going. So I can put people's names, and there are lots more names that I could have put, people whose research projects actually lie in that intersection where there are students, so they've been taught, and they're doing research on the data collected by our citizen scientists. And there are the names of the projects. You won't escape from here in time if I start getting sidetracked into talking about those projects and get carried away. So it's because of this, these overlaps, that the whole thing must be held together. So this is a bit of a political statement. People say, oh, the monitoring projects, oh, they could be done outside the university. But the reality is that the way we've set it up, it's incredibly important for us that our research and teaching is so closely entwined with our citizen science endeavor. So the second introduction is very short. These three pairs of 2 words each, which we need to be talking about our projects. Citizen science, the field work that people like yourselves do. Digital biodiversity. We have two people who work full time on databases, database design, and our collection of digital data in the computer of biodiversity data is currently around 16 million records, and that's one of the largest collections of its kind in the world of that sort. And what holds the whole thing together, the red thread that pulls it all together, is a discipline which I guess I've been in for many, many years, but which has only been given a name in the past few years, and that's called statistical ecology. So we say what we do with statistical ecology is we put biology into statistics, and we put statistics into biology. And I can give you an example of where things go wrong. So in bird ringing, you capture birds, you put rings on. Later on, you go back to the same place and you capture the birds again. And some of those birds have got rings on. And somehow in that information, there's information about the population size from the proportions that get retrapped with rings. And there's information about survival if you do very complicated statistical analysis. So the statisticians cottoned on to this problem. And they transformed the reality, the real world, going out catching birds and recatching them again. And they did it differently. They said, okay, yeah, we have an urn of marbles. And we'll put our hand in and pull some out, color them, mark them, put them back, and then we'll spin the urn at random. So we're doing another sample at random. And they worked out a whole army of statistical theory based on that. But the reality is they didn't solve the real problem that the biologists had. Because when the birds don't mix up randomly like you mix the marbles up in the urn. And so they thought that they were doing statistical ecology. They thought that they were solving the problems that the biologists had, but they weren't, right? And so it's taken a huge amount of time to actually get the two groups of people talking together, to get the statisticians and the biologists actually interfacing properly, that the statisticians are solving the real problems that the biologists have, not some imaginary abstract version. And that's what's happened for too long. And so a lot of what passes as statistical ecology in the past hasn't actually solved real problems in the real world. And that's what we are working on. And so as the ADU morphs into its future, into the next 20 years, that's the area we are moving into, is statistical ecology, solving with the best methods available, best mathematical, statistical methods available, solving the real problems. The problem is that mathematicians like their mathematics to be elegant, nice equations. But if you're actually solving the real problems of the real world, the results are, mathematics is always messy. Mathematicians, statisticians don't like that. So here's the roadmap. That's the end of my introductory blurb. Roadmap for the week. I said I'll talk about citizen science in general and introduce Atlas projects as best I can. I fear that I'll be stealing a little bit of particularly Doug's thunder, but we'll talk about that before his talk. But I'll be doing it from a slightly different angle to what he'll be doing it. Sylvia will be here tomorrow to talk about the Butterfly Atlas. The Butterfly Atlas is a project that we've actually taken the manuscript and we've given it to Sanby, and they're going to publish it. But the actual Atlas project continues, and we're working in partnership with LEPSOC, the Lepidoptera Society of Africa, and Sylvia will tell you all about that, on the sort of SABCA2, South African Butterfly Conservation Assessment continuation. Doug will talk about the Bird Atlas, and I'll be, because birds are where I come from, it's easiest for me to talk about and illustrate the concepts with Bird Atlas data. And we're on our second Bird Atlas, and the second Bird Atlas is currently ongoing. And Tully Hoffman, who's sitting here in the second row, will tell us about the Mammal Atlas, which is something which is on the verge of starting. 10 years ago, and I'm not sure if I'm stealing your thunder, 10 years ago, the Endangered Wildlife Trust, EWT, produced a red data book for mammals. And in the at the back of this huge, thick book, there are four little reports of thematic groups. And every single one of those reports, in some form or another, says, we need a mammal atlas in the same way as we have the bird atlas. That was 10 years ago, and nobody's taken up the challenge. And seeing that nobody has taken up the challenge, Tully and I are taking up the challenge. So we're launching this mammal atlas, and effectively we're launching it on Thursday, because it's the first time we've talked about it publicly. And another big citizen science project, which has provided us with a huge amount of information, is bird ringing, which gets done almost exclusively, or very largely, by amateurs. So the tackler, if you live in the southern suburbs, arrives in your letterbox every Thursday. And a couple of years ago, this was the headlines of the Tatler: the birds are gone without a song. And the article offered all sorts of reasons why the birds were disappearing. Squirrels steal eggs from nests. Sparrowhawks, much larger populations of birds of prey in our suburbs now than what they used to be. Pied crows, there are far more crows about than there were. There are these horrendous house crows, which have now more or less been eliminated. Could be the birds are just moving around. There are all sorts of other explanations were offered. Pesticides, we were told that unleaded petrol might contain benzene. And then there's just everything's made hard, paving. But the truth is that even in our own suburbs, we just don't know what the reason is. We haven't really tracked our biodiversity. And so the question that we ask is, how can I, as a citizen scientist, make a difference? Well, you can do like that picture at the start. You can be a protester, an activist. You can do things like write to your MP and write to the newspaper and all that sort of thing as a means of making a difference. And then you can do what are important things, but are not things that actually involve you in any activity. Like you can become a member of BirdLife South Africa, you can become a member of the Friends of the Liesbeek River. Jeremy Bolton is here at the back, and he will help you to sponsor a camera trap for the Cape Leopard Trust. A camera trap is a camera that's just out in the bush somewhere, and every time something walks past, it takes a picture, which is a new reason why you ought to wear clothes when you go hiking up the mountain. Because the Cape Leopard Trust tell me that it's surprising the number of people who don't wear clothes when they walk around the mountains. But those are things that you can do which are kind of passive. We want to be activists. We want to throw the stones at the bulldozer. We want to do something. And I say to you, the way you do that is to become a citizen scientist. And you get involved in projects led by scientists. And this week we're going to be talking about the ones that are part of the ADU. So, ballpark, what you have to do in a nutshell is you collect information, not just in arbitrary ways, but according to some fixed scientific protocol, and you submit it to the project. Very often it's done on the internet, but we accept that not everybody is equally happy with the internet, and most projects still accept data on paper. And these projects are largely funded by the government, by SANBI, South African National Biodiversity Institute, based here in Kirstenbosch. And why do they give us money to do these projects? It's not just for fun. They want the information to make a difference. They want the information because ultimately they use it to influence government policy in terms of biodiversity. So you can make a difference by being involved in these projects. You can make a big difference by being involved. So this piece that I'm actually going to show you in the next slide. It arrived last night while I was preparing this talk, and I found it an extremely moving piece of text, and it reads like this. So what do you get from the ADU? We want the data. We need the data. What do the people who participate get out of it? And this little piece describes what one person is getting out of. I'd written to him, he's done an amazing job for us, and I'd written to him and I'd thanked him for his for the amazing amount of work he'd done for us. And he responds, "Once again, it is me who owes the ADU the thanks. I've been a birder for many years, but did not get involved with SABAP 1, the first bird atlas, when a good friend told me about it. That friend died of leukemia at the age of 35, but his legacy continued when I started to submit to BIRP, the Birds in Reserves Project. When my wife died 4 years ago, I found that birding, and in particular BIRP, gave me a passion to continue and always got me through the tough days. So doing this work for BIRP and the ADU is a pleasure and a privilege." And I thought, gosh, you know, It's not one-way traffic, it's two-way traffic, in that the people who participate in these projects they get something out of it as well. It's not just the satisfaction of knowing that your data is influencing government policy. And one of the wonderful things about birding as a hobby and butterflying and things like that is that they are hobbies that you can keep doing when you can no longer play tennis and golf and all those sorts of things. So as a new retiree myself, I'm deeply grateful that my passion is something that I can keep doing, hopefully for a very long time. So he says, I'm the one having a ball on a daily basis and telling that people that retirement is so busy, I don't know how I ever found time for work. And I think that's an amazing story, and it arrived while I was doing the preparations. I didn't have a chance to ask his permission to present this to you this morning, but I thought, well, seeing that it had arrived while I was doing the preparation, it was something that I really ought to share with you. So, you know, we want the data you can collect, but likewise, everybody at different levels gains out of participation. And in a real sense, one of the things that you gain is a basic understanding of the scientific method. You have to collect your data according to these protocols. And the hardest people to deal with are the people who say, you don't want to do it the way you've planned it, you must do it the way I want you to do it. And we really struggle with citizen scientists who come back to us with that. So he has a bunch of citizen scientists out bird ringing. The chap at the net, this net with all the birds, and this is stuff that Dieter will tell you about on Friday, is Mike Ford, who's a retired person at Hermanus. So lots of patience is needed to go bird ringing, nimble fingers, got to look at these birds in the hand very carefully, and a bunch of other things that you need. Now, as Janet hinted, I've not been this part of the game for all my life. I came in as a sort of coordinator of citizen science, to some extent, having been a citizen scientist myself. And what I'm about to tell you now is for me one of the best parts of citizen science in my life, when I was actually a bird ringer myself and not in charge of bird ringing. I was just another ringer. It's also a bit of a sad story, so you have to forgive that piece of it. This sandling is in the collection at the Moscow State University in Moscow, the taxonomy collection. And if you look carefully, you'll see the bird has a ring on the top leg in the top left-hand corner of that picture. Now, that was a ring that I put on that bird. And it was ringed at Komiki. And we moved out of the old ADU into zoology towards the end of last year. And I had to clear my office. It was a major mission. So finally, after being in zoology for about 4 years, the university finally found a space in the zoology building. And this letter was one letter I found. 1 November 1990. So it's a year older than what the ADU is. And the bloke who wrote it, Pavel Tomkovich, was one of the supervisors of the black girl who graduated with her PhD last year, Yarkat Barship from Nigeria. So it's a long story. 1990, if you think back, and all of us here except Tully can think back that far, was still Soviet Union. The Russians were still, the Soviets were still the people we feared the most, the people who we had to look for under our beds every night before we got into bed. And 1990, things had thawed sufficiently that Pavel Tomkovich could put a letter in the post in Moscow, and it actually got delivered here. It was before that there was no connection between the countries. Any post got removed. And the first paragraph of the letter says, "It was a pleasant surprise to read that the Sandiling with Cape Town ring, South African ring, which I've shot on the Tymer last summer, was ringed by you." So the second paragraph goes on to explain why he shot it. So Pavel Tomkovich, professional ornithologist at the museum in Moscow, his job actually consists of turning birds into specimens. And that's it's another debate, another story as to whether that's something we should be doing. But the bottom line is that a huge amount of the biodiversity information that we have is comes out of the specimens in the museums. So we can't criticize Pavel for shooting the bird. And he was reluctant to shoot it, but that particular day they were, I think the next picture shows the tundra. They were out in the tundra. They were far from their camp. They would never get back to that spot again. And they saw this bird, little bird with the ring on it. And they said, "We've got to find out where that bird was ringed." And the only thing they could do was to short shoot the poor thing. And then they discovered that the ring had come from South Africa. And to this day, that bird remains the only bird, shorebird, ringed in South Africa, actually recovered on the breeding grounds in the Tymer Peninsula. I was desperately lucky. I've made two trips there, one in Soviet Union times and one a bit more recently. But if you ever get the chance to go to the Tymer Peninsula, so if you look at the map of the world and you look at India, the Tymer Peninsula is directly above India. It's just a few hundred kilometers from the North Pole. And the Tymer Peninsula is the world's greatest wader factory. So most of the birds that you see at places like Langebaan Lagoon, on the lagoon, the migrant waders, most of them come from the Tymer Peninsula. It's an amazing place. And that's where Pavel does his research. So the critical thing about this is his next sentence. So once again, birds provide contacts between people of different hemispheres. And this was, in this particular case, contact between a citizen scientist and a professional ornithologist. So I ringed this sandling on the beach at Komiki. You won't find sandling on the beach at Komiki anymore because of declining populations, climate change, the tundra is changing, there aren't as many waders anymore, and they don't have to come this far south to find a place to spend the northern winter. So he shot it on the 2nd of July 1990. The distance between the ringing place and the shooting place was 13,000 kilometers, and the bird wouldn't have, that's the great circle distance on the map, the shortest distance, the bird would have flown further. So the only reason why I could ask Pavel to send me pictures of this particular bird was because he'd shot it, and in a real sense this bird lives on because it was ringed by a citizen scientist and shot by a serious taxidermist. Otherwise you wouldn't be able to go to the Moscow Museum and find this little bird. So that's the take-home message, the contacts between people, different hemispheres. This was another citizen scientist. This was a man who had enormous influence on my life, a chap the name of Manfred Waltner. He was an Austrian. He worked in the textile industry, and he taught us a huge amount about birds. So he was a citizen scientist. And there's this amazing wetland in Oman called Bahr al-Hikman. And that first paragraph of text describes how this group of ringers, Dutch ringers, and they were not professional ornithologists, they were citizen scientists. They'd gone on this expedition to this amazing wetland in Oman, and somebody had brought in a bird in a bag and had given it to a chap by the name of Raymond, his surname I forget, and said, "This bird is going to make you happy." And then Raymond's rather effusive email, "Cold-handed, cold-sweated, I opened the bag to find a bar-tailed godwit. But it's just another bar-tailed godwit," I said. "Just check the legs," Roland replied. When I read out the inscription on the ring, "Pretoria," the whole ringing table burst out in great excitement. It was only after our return to Europe that we learnt about the ringing details. Colin Jackson is one of my PhD students. "You will not believe this. Your godwit was ringed in Langebaan Lagoon, on the west coast of the Cape, on the 7th of October 1988. So that was a retrap. The bird still flies on, hopefully, and this bird was 20 years old. And if you work out distances, this bird breeds in the same general area as the sandling breeds. 20 years, 25,000 kilometers a year both ways. That's something like 500,000 kilometers that this bird has flown, and that's more than what you'd hope to get out of several motor vehicles. Amazing. And this information discovered by citizen scientists. So from our perspective, the benefits is that a well-designed citizen science project can multiply our effectiveness as professional biologists a bazillionfold. So we can't get everywhere at the same time. We're confined to being in one place at one time. The amount of data we can collect is very little. And then, as citizen scientists, the skills you learn, and in particular, I think it's map reading skills, are of huge benefit to society, but I won't go into that. So ultimately, in conservation, biodiversity conservation, South Africa, as well as globally, one of the big shortfalls is a lack of good data. People sit around tables and they say, "What should we do to solve this particular problem?" And sadly, an awful lot of the decisions that get taken as to how we should manage elephants or do this or do that is based on a bunch of people sitting around, and the bloke who shouts the loudest is the one who wins the day. So we, you know, even this stage of the 21st century, we are desperately short of real hard data to base conservation decisions on. And that's where you as citizen scientists can make a huge difference. So what do you need? Basically, enthusiasm, passion, that's what we're looking for. You need a certain amount of capacity, of spare time, and if you looked at the profile of the people who participate in, say, for the Bird Atlas project, the profile is exactly the same as the profile of the people in this room, because that's the reality, is that it's when you stop working very often that you actually have the time to pursue these things. And as I've hinted several times, you have to be prepared to knuckle down and work within the framework of whatever protocol has been designed for the project. A lot of thought goes into designing these protocols. So quite a few of the talks are about Atlas projects. What is an Atlas? So we take a map of the country and we divide it according to some sort of grid into little squares, little cells. And for the bird atlas, and effectively the same sort of thing for the other projects, the citizen scientists make lists, and we capture the information. We plot maps which show which grid cells the species was actually recorded in. And that's the map there which came out of the first bird atlas project based on this system for the first bird atlas. Published 1997, 13 plus 12, 25 years ago. No, 3 plus 12, 15 years ago, but based on data collected a long time ago. This is the map of Switzerland. This is the map showing the results of the first, their first and second Swiss Atlas projects. And the squares, which are coloured with zebra stripes, black and white stripes, are the grid cells in Switzerland in which the peregrine falcon was observed in their first atlas. And the ones that are coloured green are the ones where the peregrine falcon was observed in the second atlas. And this demonstrates the recovery of the peregrine falcon after the pesticide, the DDT disaster that impacted them a bunch of years earlier. So the second atlas is incredibly valuable for detecting changes, for doing these detecting early warning systems for biodiversity. And so one of the things that that people ask about these projects is, will I waste my time and my money being involved? What is the track record of the organization? Does it actually finish the projects that it starts? And I'm now going to be stealing a bit of Doug's thunder, so I'm actually going to actually skip my way through this little piece and talk about the second bird atlas. 15 years since we started it. But the reality is that bird distributions are changing very rapidly, and it's one of the easiest things to detect. Second Bird Atlas, joint project SANBI, South African National Biodiversity Institute, they want the data for policy. BirdLife South Africa is the big bird conservation NGO in the country, and ourselves. So it's a partnership between government, an NGO, and academic things. And all our Atlas projects have been based on that model. That's the black sunbird. There was a map that was produced by Jack Skeed, and the black dots are the places where there were specimens in museums of black sunbirds. So this is one of the uses of museum specimens. It actually is to put them all together and get a distribution map. And then the first edition of Roberts came out with maps, and this is a grossly enlarged picture of the map. And that's what Liversidge and McLachlan thought was the distribution of the black sunbird. And the last edition of Roberts that came out before the Atlas was Gordon MacLean's, and that was his map for the distribution of the black sunbird. And when the Atlas came out, the map I showed you before, this is the distribution. And you put the four maps together and they look nothing like each other. In fact, the maps that coincide the most are the ones, is the one at the top left-hand corner, the Skeed map, and the True map, the one which is actually based on the citizen science data. And you see the there are records through the Limpopo Valley between South Africa and Zimbabwe, but they're quite thin. And if you have a look at the Skeed map, There are no records in that area. So the Hot Limpopo Valley is a corridor in which black sunbirds, what are now called amethyst sunbirds, don't occur. And the amethyst sunbird, the black sunbird, is actually an interesting species because it's one of the species which is now popping up in the Western Cape, along with hardy dars, fork-tailed drongos, and a whole lot of things which we are monitoring through the Atlas projects is actually coming towards us. And all the squares that are coloured blue on that map are squares where amethyst sunbird is now occurring and didn't occur during the first Atlas. So this is amethyst sunbird in somebody's feeder, just a kilometre or two from here. So we started this new Atlas project. We started at the beginning of July. Not a single record on the map. 2 years later, the coverage map, where we'd got data from our citizen scientists, looked like that. We had 28% of the area covered. July last year, 53% of the area covered. And I did one of these things last night, and we're now at 58% coverage. 100,000, 10,000 of our pentads covered, of our little grid cells covered. And there are 17,000 of these things in the country. So there's lots of scope for people still to be involved. The shading of the map is in proportion to the amount of data that we've got. And you can see an awful lot of South Africa is still yellow, which means there's only one checklist being submitted for that little grid cell. So there's lots of space for work. And what have we learnt? And I have chosen three species to show the changes that take place, which we've only discovered because of the citizen science involvement. The black stork is a pretty thin on the ground species. You don't see it frequently. And what we didn't realize was that we were almost seeing it nowhere. So the red squares on this map are places where black stork was recorded in the first bird atlas, but has not yet been recorded, or not been recorded. We're 4.5 years into the second bird atlas, not been recorded at all. And that's pretty alarming that without us noticing, the species has almost gone out of existence in South Africa. The black stork is quite a common bird in Europe. So this is a really interesting story of a species that has another subspecies that occurs in Africa, southern Africa, but it's going extinct. Nobody tells you that the black stork is going extinct. It's something we only found out because of this project. We wouldn't have noticed it otherwise. Blue crane is our national bird. And you can see in comparison up here, that is the northern parts of South Africa. So this is a species that's almost endemic to South Africa. There's a small population in Namibia. So endemic means it only endemic to South Africa means it only occurs in South Africa. That's why it was chosen as the national bird. In the northern part of the country, it's going extinct, all the red squares. The green squares and the blue squares are places where it's becoming more common. So across the wheat fields of the Swartland, the Overberg, the blue crane is increasing in abundance. In agricultural landscapes mostly. And that's amazing that now the existence of our national bird actually depends on the way we do agriculture in the Swartland and the Overberg. If agriculture changes from present systems, we potentially lose the species. How have we found this out? We found this out on the contributions of people just like yourself to this project. Secretary bird is another species which is, though the map is mostly red, the species occurred in the first atlas in that square, hasn't been recorded yet. So that's another species which nobody had really wave the red flag for. And there are lots of examples like this, and Doug will be talking about them later on. Indian Minor. All that blue is new range for the Indian Minor, going into the even into the Kruger National Park. So this is an invasive species that's spread. The green over Gauteng, over the Witwatersrand, is increasing reporting rates. By the time of the first bird atlas, there were just handfuls of records of Indian miners, common miners as they're called these days, across there. But what is actually astonishing is this. So that's the original core of the range of the Indian Minor, Common Minor, KwaZulu-Natal. And they are, just bizarrely, there are quarter degree grid cells, there are squares on this map which are red. The species was there in the first atlas and not in the second. So this is something that nobody in their right minds even thought, said maybe Indian Minor is becoming less common in its former core range in KwaZulu-Natal. We don't have answers. All we have is we've actually now, through this, we've alerted people to this change. Pied crow is another species. And perhaps a lot of our bird conservation problems are actually put at the door of the green, the increasing abundance of pied crows over all this area. So if somebody's passionate, they can do a PhD on the pied crow. It seems to me the least exciting species, least charismatic species to do a PhD on, but it's certainly something that that needs to be done. So you can stand in front of the bulldozers, be an activist in that way, but our invitation to you is to become an activist in this new way of actually providing data into these projects. And the next lectures in the series will basically tell you in more detail how to do it. So we'd like you all to get on track as citizen scientists. So thank you very much. I've gone deep into injury time, but we've got a couple of minutes and I'm happy to try and answer any questions anybody might have. Yes.
If we collect data, do we register with you? What's our relationship with your unit?
Yes. Okay. So that's the question which basically Sylvia, Doug, Tully and Ditta will be answering in the course. How do you actually get involved? And basically, one of the things you need to do is to register as an observer, which means that that you get an observer number. And if you just use that number, that's all the information you have to give us, because then you don't have to provide us with email address and all that other sort of stuff. So it becomes easier to submit data once you've registered. Ditta, I know in particular, will go into some detail as to how to actually do it. That's an incredibly important question, and for things like the Atlas Project, we run workshops on participation, training in the protocols, and how to get the data into the system. I doubt it. The cost of producing something on paper is just so huge in this day and age that almost certainly it's going to be a web-based publication, which seems to be the way to go. And also, as soon as it's on paper, it's immediately out of date, whereas if it's an internet thing, it can be kept continuously up to date. So that seems to be the way in which the world is moving. John?
Has the data been transferred into policy? mean, is there like in NEMA protected areas that, for example, has that incorporated data that has been collected by such consultants?
Well, things like deciding which species should be included in those lists of species which are endangered in the regulations attached to those acts, those lists are largely based on looking at least for birds, looking at the actual bird atlas data. So things which have come out of the Atlas projects are the red data books, and the red data books basically for frogs, for reptiles, for butterflies, for birds, provide a huge amount of guidance as to where research funding is spent. That's the technique for flagging species, for looking at particularly carefully in environmental impact assessments and things like that. So the results do get translated actually into policy on the ground.
Does one have regular access as citizen scientist to the broad information that is available to the unit or not?
Do the citizen scientists have any particular access? No, and the reason why the answer is no is that everybody has access to the data. So we've tried. Well, I'm embarrassed to say, when we were doing the first atlas, we were choose a polite word. I was going to say bedonned. We were frenetic about not letting anybody see the data, because we thought they might preempt the publication. But we quickly learnt afterwards. It took us a couple of years, I'm embarrassed to say. We quickly learnt that the best thing to do. We're in biodiversity conservation. It's not in our interest, not in the animals' interest, to actually hold on to data, is to let the data go. So we basically try as far as possible. And of course, you have sensitive species that you can't just let the data out. So there's all sorts of issues like that. But as far as possible, the data is open access. So the participants don't have any particular access to the data, but of course everybody has access to the data. That's one of our founding principles, and now I'm embarrassed. Well, founding principles, one of our current principles, but was when we started, we certainly didn't think like that. But we had to change and actually say, all the stuff is freely available to anyone who needs it, and particularly those who have to take decisions in terms of biodiversity. And we try and make the data accessible to things like government departments, Department of Environment Affairs, who have to take decisions on environmental impact assessments that are sent to them. And they need to be able to check whether the species list which they are told occurs at a site is true. And we have to provide them with the tools to actually do that kind of checking. Yes, it will include the rhino, and that's a good point. We have been challenged. What can we do to make a difference to the rhino? We as the Animal Demography Unit, and if you can help Tully and I answer that question, we'd be hugely grateful. What can we do? And certainly, I don't think we will be, as a sensitive species, I don't think we'll be putting the rhino maps onto the website like we do the Indian minor map. So it would be irresponsible. Yeah.
I was in Kenya in 1994, 1995, and there the rhino were a very endangered species, and the government actually provided a bodyguard for every rhino, and that bodyguard had instructions to shoot, kill, if somebody tried to attack Iran. I don't know whether that is still so, but that was in 1994.
Gosh. So, John, I was instructed to bring this to an end.
Frivolous question. Is that rubber line in use?
Yes.
Yes, it is. The track is is shiny, so it's not a rusty track here. Right, thank you very much. Sylvia will be here in the morning to talk about the butterfly atlas. Thank you.